Ein Omet Beis, okay. Sorry. Then the Mishnah continues and it says, Ad Yomov, Hoya Patish Makab Yerushalayim. Right. First of all, until his days, a hammer would clop in Yerushalayim, would strike in Yerushalayim. All right, I like the word clop, it sounds better. More forceful. So now we have to discuss, I mean, what are we talking about over here? What hammer, what is it, you know, what is it striking, what is it clopping, okay? So Rashi explains. There is a Gemara which is called Moed Katan. Have you heard of it? Yeah. Moed Katan deals primarily, although not exclusively, two major areas, okay. But the major area, actually, the one that occupies most of it, is the fact that it deals with laws of what can you do during Chol HaMoed and what can you not do in Chol HaMoed. Okay? Very it deals with also the laws of Avelus. Okay? And that's the makor, that's the source for many of the practices that we still observe to this day when Rachman and Islan, we become Avelus. Okay? But the major part, as I said, deals with primarily what are you allowed to do on Chol HaMoed and what can you not do on Chol HaMoed. Okay. Generally speaking, Chol HaMoed is meant to be a period, it's a yontif. And therefore, you should not be doing any melacha as a normal rule on yontif. Even though it is Chol HaMoed, right? It's not the Mikvah Kodesh days, it's not, you know, the beginning and the end of the Yontif, but nevertheless, even during Chol HaMoed, you shouldn't be doing Melacha. That's the basic rule. Instead, you should be celebrating it, you should dress, you should eat well, and so forth and so on. And I'll tell you the truth. When you're in Yerushalayim, you really have a feeling of what Chol HaMoed is like. Because offices are closed, many businesses are closed during the entire period, and the only thing the shock is, see, you're observing the second day Yontif, and lo and behold, you see Frumi Yidden with veils and payas, and then the wives and so on are all dressed up in their Yontif Nikabes, and then they're running to catch the bus or cabs and so on and go all over. Naturally, the Kotel is a very favorite place to go visit, but also they have what they call Luna Park. What's Luna Park? They have, like, you know, carousels, rides for the kids and things like that, you know, during Chol HaMoed, because the kids are off and the families have a chance to get together and celebrate. So it's quite an experience. It's very much unlike Chol HaMoed over here, I have to tell you, in Springfield.
But you're allowed to work on Chol HaMoed, right?
Okay. Are you or are you not allowed? The answer is
if you lose
there's one category of labor which is permitted, and that is what we call Meleches Dovah HaOved. Well, actually, there are two categories. That's one category. The other one is things that have to be Tzorchei Rabbim. In other words, things that you're doing for the public in general, okay? But the other one, Meleches Dovah HaOved, this means that you are permitted to do something that if you don't do it, then the thing will be ruined. It will go to ruin.
What if you don't work?
Meleches Dovah HaOved. Something that will be lost altogether if you don't do it. Okay?
Well, like a panosa.
Well, that's a question about panosa. I agree with you.
Right?
But, yeah, of course. But many people hold, you know, many of the chachamim hold that the person should have bitachon, celebrate Chol HaMoed, right? Not do any work, and the Rebbeinu Shlomo will make it up to him during the course of the year. That's real bitachon, okay?
You're talking about Pesach and Sukkot.
Talking right. Of course, Chol HaMoed only applies to Pesach and Sukkot, because they're the only two times where we have a Chol HaMoed. Okay. So, as I say, Meleches Dovah HaOved. For example, let's say that you're a farmer, okay? And you have a crop in the field that's simply going to go to ruin if you don't
harvest it.
Okay? The thing will simply be completely lost. So that's Malachus HaRoche. Okay. So that's one thing which is permitted to do. The other thing, as I said, is Tzorchi Rabbi. In other words, the community depends upon you to do this. For example, to open a grocery store in Chol HaMoed, this is permitted. Why? People have to eat. So you are providing a service for the community.
I wouldn't buy that. Let them buy it up stuff so they don't have to go open a store.
Fine.
I would say maybe a doctor or a dentist or somebody who is taking care of the sick.
Okay.
That is okay.
So it's also Tzorchi Rabbi.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right?
Look, I'll be honest with you. When I had to teach in school, I had to teach in Chol HaMoed. So I could justify it on the fact that I was performing the service to the community by doing it. You understand? But otherwise, you have to, you should refrain from labor during Chol HaMoed and celebrate Yom Tov. Okay. Now, what does this have to do with this business over here? So the answer is, according to Rashi, that, you know, people were engaged in necessary work on behalf of the tzibur, on behalf of the community, and so they would do the banging for whatever it had to be. But, as a result, people who came to Yerushalayim, you know, in order to celebrate Yom Tov over there, and naturally they didn't just go just for one day of Yom Tov, they would stay. So, they would get the wrong impression that anything goes. He can clap, so I can clap too. I can do whatever I want to, you understand?
Clap.
So therefore, this is why he decided to abolish, to make a rule saying that during Chol HaMoed, the sound of clapping should not be heard in Jewish language. In other words, blacksmiths or whoever, you know, that they were doing this work, they were not to perform it during Chol HaMoed in order not to mislead people that anything goes during Chol HaMoed. Okay?
No.
Yeah, right. Uvi Yomov, and in his days, Ein Tzorch Nishalah Dumai. So now, we have to define what is Dumai. Dumai means, we're not sure whether the, let's say, fruit, grain, whatever it may be, whether this food is free from, has, for example, have trumas and maestras and so on been taken from, you know, the plant from which it came. You understand? Their experience is a very important factor. Very important. Yeah. Okay. So how come Ein Tzorach L'Shaul? That's the question. So the answer is as follows. He instituted the following regulation. Until then, the presumption was that the trumas, maestros, and so on had been taken already at the source, so to speak. In other words, the farmer would not sell the produce without having first taken trumas and maestros from it, okay? But he came to the conclusion that there were too many amoratsim who were simply neglecting to take trumas and maestros.
We got a bunch of adulterers, we got a bunch of murderers.
So this is why I say, over here at this particular point, we deal with a society which is going downhill, okay? And we're not finished yet. We're only finished for the time being, but we'll have more problems as we go on. Okay. But to a certain extent, it reminds us of our own age in which we are living.
Yeah, but we're not there. We're golden compared to them over there.
Well, we have a president who is not exactly a model of propriety.
Let's not be political now.
Nothing. Just mentioning the fact that, you know, it's not setting a very good example. Okay. All right. So, as I said, until this point, then it was the producer, the farmer, who was responsible for it. Now, when he saw that there were so many amoratsim around, so he said, okay, from this point on, Ein Tzorach L'Shaul Alei, don't even ask any question about doubtful products as to whether The farmer has done it. Instead, you have the responsibility now of taking care of the...
Who is he saying you? Who is you?
You, the customer.
Oh, the customer.
You, the customer. Right.
How can you be sure?
Okay. All right, you ask him a good question. You go to Eretz Yisrael, okay? And in order to try to make sure that things are being done properly, trumas and masmas and so on are being taken, okay? You have certain stores where, you know, they have an inspection by the Beis Din, Beit HaCharedus, for example, and they know that here the storekeeper is very careful in removing, you know, the trumas and masmas. It's a certain amount, you know, that you have to do, okay? Naturally, we don't give any more tumor to a kohen because the kohen is not in the state of purity to eat it. Understand? And maestros also, we don't give to the levy anymore.
So
because we're not altogether certain, you know, about the
levy. Who do they give it to?
The answer is that either they feed it to the animals or something like that. And so on, okay? And then also with other things, maestros shading, you know, which used to be brought to Yerushalayim. So that they redeem by means of a coin, and you make a stipulation that this coin will take care of the year's worth of Maaser Sheni, something like that. Okay,
symbolic.
Okay, so this is, I say, this is if you buy in a store which has, you know, a teudah, has a document, a, you know, attesting to the fact that Trumas and Maaseris are taken care of already at the source. Okay, but what if you go to the average market where it's not?
Mm-hmm.
Then in that case, you, the housekeeper, have the obligation to do it. And so I've seen my daughter, for example, take care of it. I've seen my daughter-in-law take care of it. To take a certain part, let's say if you buy a sack of oranges or something like that, that you'll take one orange and put it aside and not use it or something like that. And instead,
feed
you save it
to the cat or the dog.
Right, you feed it to, yeah, whatever it may be, okay?
Doesn't sound right to me.
Well, you see, we're not obligated because the stuff that we eat grows in America. This is only something
that... Even over there, I don't see where it's practical.
See, these are dinner which are to William Morris.
When I was at Mahal Gaon, they taught us to do it, I think we just throw it in the garbage because we didn't have
lots of
cash.
Yeah.
So,
all right.
But
at any rate, you still removed it.
Yeah. It's a waste, it's an error.
Yeah.
But if
that's
the only way to make the food...
Yeah. Well, when were you at Machon Gold, incidentally? Because my daughter was there in her junior year.
Long time.
Yeah, well, my daughter too. Let's see. She graduated Stern in 1944, so in other words, she spent the year. No. No, that's way
enough.
74, excuse me. So, the year of 73, 74, this is when she was in Machon Gold.
Oh,
yeah.
So, now she's there during the Yom Kippur War?
I came back just prior to the Yom Kippur War. Yeah.
Wow.
I guess, was it 72, 73, I guess it must have been, yeah. Because I remember they came home, and then the Yom Kippur War broke out after they were already home. Of course, while they were there, you know, Yom HaTzmaut was a big thing with parades and everything else, and that's a hoo-ha. And then, the sky fell, right. So, at any rate...
There's a lot of questions about that.
I know that my daughter, she doesn't. I just want to conclude one other thing as far as, Demai is concerned. If you'll take a look on products that come from Israel, I'm talking now about canned goods, one of the things that you can examine to see is whether trumas and maestros and tevel means that nothing was ever done. I mean, no truma, no maestro or anything like that. So they'll say, and also, usually we'll say that it is noki, it is clean, nechashash, from any suspicion, literally, you know, from any doubt as to whether, you know, trumas, maestros, shvias is another thing, you know, that this should not be something which grew in the seventh year and then they use it for commercial purposes. So where there's a careful supervision, you'll find these things over there. All right, do we have time to do a little bit more? Well, let's learn a little bit more to Gemara over here, and then we'll call it night. Yes.
But it says, you would think that that Lashon sounds more like that he made it so that you wouldn't even have to worry about the money.
I understand.
Instead of exactly the opposite, which
that's
is
correct. It's correct. It all depends, you know, on how you understand it. That's why we need a Gemara in order to interpret what the Mishnah is trying to say. Okay? Because from the words alone, in the Mishnah, you definitely could come to the same conclusion that what you stated.
Actually,
so that's why I'm trying to. Right.
The way that they handle it now,
yeah.
They can kind of assume that a certain amount rots, and,
right.
And that's
right.
What they.
Yeah.
They also ain't
yeah.
Like mine,
correct. But as you can see, if you take a look at the Rashi, you can see over there it says. Yeah, why don't we read the Rashi at the top over there? Okay, it says Ad Yom Lev Hoyapatish Mak Yerushalayim. Right, it says Beveis Hanapachim in blacksmith's places. Right, Bechulo Shel Moed during Chol Hamoed. Laseis Melaches Dover Hoved Shemuteres. Right, when they were doing work which, you know, it would perish otherwise, it would be ruined if, and this is permissible in Yantar. Let's say, for example, an animal had to be shoed or something like that. You know, he had a horse and he had to put a shoe on or something like that. So the blacksmith would have to do it. Or maybe you needed a pot or something to cook, and you needed, you know, to get a repair or something like that. Okay. So the Amadhu, so he arose, the Gozar Alanapochim, and he made a gezerah. In other words, he made a decree concerning the blacksmiths that are filled with Dover HaOved, they are not permitted to do it, right? Because the sound of the hammering can be heard at a distance. And not everybody is aware of the fact. Okay? So the Gemara in Moed Katan deals with that and mentions it. Okay. And then Kol Yomov, Lohutzva Cholom Nisholo Chavira Mai, says, Im Usar, you know, whether the Maisa has been taken from it, Im Lab, or not. Shehu Hiskin, because he made a takono, Shehu Kol Haloichim Yam Horetz Ma'asmin, that whoever buys produce from in Am Horetz, then he has to take the responsibility of giving Maisris and so on from it. So that's why. And so the Shalat Mai, because now he put the responsibility upon the customer rather than upon the farmer or the seller or whatever they be. Tanu Rabbanon, our sages taught us, Menayin Shem Nerfo HaEgla. How do we know that? Now the Gemara is explaining the mission, okay? How do we know that if the heifer had already, you know, been slain, the achakach nimsa horeg, and afterwards the murderer is discovered, she'ein poteres oso, that this action of, you know, the paraduma, the egla rufa, it does not free him from the penalty that he has to face. So Talmud Loma, because the pasuk says, v'lo ores lo yechupar, Ladom asher shupach bo, that the land will not be forgiven for the blood which has been shed in it, kiyim bedam shofcho, except for, you know, except by the blood of the one who slayed, you know, committed the murder. Okay. So that therefore, if we know who the murderer is, then the egla rufa does not excuse him. He still has to face judgment. And so another one says no, right? So he says, Tamor the Machashis. The reason being that one contradicts the other, right? But if there were no contradiction, then in that case, Eid Echod Mehemon. Then in this particular case, namely about testifying about, you know, whether he saw a murder, right? He would be believed. How do we know that this is so? The Tana Rabbanon, because our sages interpreted the pasuk. It says, "Lo no da yihi kohu." Right? Pasuk says, "It is not known who slayed him, who killed him." Right? Ha no da mihi kohu. But if it is known who slayed him, then in that case, afilu echad b'seifa oilam lo hoyu ofen. Then even if there's only one witness, no matter where in the world that witness is, but a witness is there who saw that the murder was committed, then in that case, you're not allowed to have the egla arufa take place. Rabbi Akiva Omer, he says, Minayel is Sanhedrin.
If you have one witness that does what, knows the murder took place or knows who the murderer is,
saw a murder take place. Now remember, one witness cannot condemn a person to death on the basis of one witness. But one witness has the power, so to speak, right? To do right, that we don't have egla rufa. Okay. Rabbi Akiva Omer says, "Minayel is Sanhedrin. How do we know that it is Sanhedrin? Shiro echot shahorag es hanefesh. If they saw one person, they saw a person killing. They saw a man killing.
Committing murder.
The aimak hirin also, but they don't know the identity of this person. They know that it's been done. They saw a person." But they don't know the identity. Who is this person who did it? And in that case, shelo hayu ofim. So in that case, we do not have the egla rufa. Even if they don't know the, So Talmud Lomar, because the Torah says, bi'einenu lo ro'u. Our eyes did not see. V'halo ro'u, says the Gemara. But didn't they see? I mean, they did see it. So he says, hashtu da amrit eid echod mehemon. Right? Now that you say that one witness will be believed in the case of the Egla Rufa, right? So either Chad Echimotzi Machish, so in that case, now the Gemara wants to know, how can another one come along and contradict him? So Omar Ula, didn't Ula say, Kol Mokom Sheemina Torah Eid Echod Hare Kan Shnayim, that wherever the Torah gives the validity to recognize the testimony of only one witness, that it has the same force as if it were two witnesses, right? The ein devar shel echad b'mkom shnayim. Not only that, but we say that one witness is not strong enough to contradict the testimony of two witnesses, right? So omer lecha ula. So therefore, Ula said as follows, says, Tani, let's understand the Mishnah's meaning, lo hayu ofen. Then in that particular case, since we have a whole business of doubt, therefore there is no, he says, there is no egla rufa. V'chein amar Yitzchok, and Rabbi Yitzchok, always also said the same thing, is Ula, Tani, lo hayu ofen, not to. But we see that Rabbi Chiya, Omar, Tani, hayu ofen. He disagrees, and he says that they would have the egla rufa, even if it's one against two in this particular case. But of course, we didn't say that the Mishnah worked on that basis. Yeah.
Who is the witness? They come and they say, we do not see blood being shed. Right?
Yeah.
He takes the we did not violate the precepts of hospitality or escort or giving nutrients and things like that. Now, when they say that, they to their best knowledge, this is the truth. This is what they witnessed or did not witness. Why then, unless the witness is from their city or one of this group, why then would a witness maybe an anonymous man who comes along and said, I saw this murder, why would that invalidate their
you mean the kapora?
Yeah, exactly.
The fact that they have to have this ceremony in order to seek atonement for what has happened. Okay? But it's based upon the fact, you see, that since the Torah says, Lo noda mihi kohu, so therefore he says, therefore if we know, if there is somebody who knows mihi kohu, even if they can't identify him, but they're aware, I mean, they saw something happen in that case, you don't bring an egla roof. The egla roof is good only for suffix. We said that in the Mishnah before, remember? Only because we're in doubt as to how the murder took place and who did it and so on and so forth. But if we know with certainty, then in that case there's no egla roof.
When they're saying the egla roof, that they're saying their entire, they're representing the entire city.
Right. So if there's a person in the city who did see it, then they can't say our eyes have not seen it. Yes, somebody here did see it. They have to be from their city, right? Yeah. Okay, which is logical. Well, that's my question. Yeah, well, it doesn't have to be a witness specifically from their city, because it says that if it's even eight echad, afilu b'sof ha'olam.
Yeah, but the murder happened here. So it,
yeah.
Now he's the sof ha'olam, but when you know, it happened, he was
right.
Here.
Right.
So.
He was. Yeah. Okay, I think I'm going to call a halt at this point. I'm getting a little tired.
What's today? It's March 3rd, 1999.
Yeah. Correct. Right. Okay, it also happens to be, well, already since it's dark, so we have to say it's already as Zion, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the month of Adar.
Of Adar, they
right.
have to.
Yeah.
This is Shushan Purim.
Right, right. Okay. Brother Mayor, I thought you'd be here for Mincha Maariv. No, weren't able to make it.
You don't want that on the recorder, do you?
All right. All right. Now, I just want to call your attention again to a couple of lines before this, all right? Let's go back just about four lines, you know, where after they discuss the Mishnah, they quote the Mishnah which says, Eid echad omer o yisir sahurik, right? If one witness says, I saw the murderer, then as we said, that in that particular case, there is no egla rufa, right? Because since egla rufa has to be for suffix, we don't know who did it, and here one person says that he does know it, okay? So, the problem is, that we now have then is the problem of one witness, right? Now, so what did we say at the very end over there, the quotation? The quotation says, right, that how do we know, right, that one witness would be believed, you know, to say that in this particular case that he saw the murderer who had committed the murder, right, and therefore, you know, there's no Eglah Rufa. How do we know they can believe one witness in such a case? And the Gemara says, "Benohani Billy, where do we know this?" So he says, "The Tana Rabbanan, this is a teaching that we have, that which says, Lo noda mihi kohu, that we don't know who slay, who slew the, you know, the person. So, ho noda mihi kohu, but if it is known, you know, who did it, then afilo echad b'sefer olam lo hiyo ofen. Then, even if it is only one, and here I'm going to put the stress upon the word, what? Echad. You could be at the other ends of the world, right? This is what we said, that in that particular case, if somebody is aware of the identity of the murderer, then in that case, lo hayu ofen, in that case, there's no egla rufa. All right? So now, obviously, the problem is going to be, first of all, about this last statement that we made, but even more so, we're going to see, is the problem about one witness against other witnesses. Okay.
In other words, either the lenient side or the mountain.
Correct.
Side.
Right. The lenient side would be that we're not orif. In other words, we don't commit. Subject the poor heifer. You know, to as a result of it. Whereas the chumrah would be that we do, that we go ahead with the service of Eglav Rufa. Okay. Okay, and it's good to bear in mind because we'll come back again to that a few lines further down. Okay? Alright, now we continue. It says, Rabbi Akiva Omer, Rabbi Akiva says as follows, it says, Minayin Sanhedrin, how do we know that if the Sanhedrin, Shero Echot Shehogas HaNefesh, if they saw someone committing the murder, right, the Ein Makirin also, this is the new twist over here, that they cannot identify the murderer. They saw it, right, but they cannot identify, they don't know who it is. Shelo HaYehofin, in that case also there is no Egla Arufa. Before we said, when there is a question or doubt, why does the Egla Arufa come? Comes because we don't know who did it, right? Here, we don't know the identity of the murderer, but nevertheless, people have seen the murder committed. So in that particular case, there is no Egla Arufa. Why? Because what does the Pasuk say? Talmud Lomar, right? The Pasuk that they quote in order to prove this point of view is V'yeinenu lo ra'u, right? Our eyes did not see. V'alo ra'u. But didn't they see it? After all, they did see it, right? So in that particular case, we have to say that inasmuch as they saw the murderer, then in that particular case, there is no Egla Rufa, because the Torah has said in connection with Egla Rufa that it has to be V'yeinenu lo ra'u, our eyes have not seen. Since they saw it, then that's it. Okay, so there's no Egla Rufa. So, now the Gemara comes, yes.
How can they be sure without two witnesses that the person is saying that he saw the witness, saw the murder, and that he's actually telling the truth?
Well, remember we raised the question last week.
Yeah, different burden of proof.
Yeah.
See, one is to convict somebody, they're going to put them to death, so
right.
They need a very high standard of proof to convict someone.
Right.
All
you
right?
cannot do
Here,
it
this is
unless
more
there
like
are two witnesses, at least. I'll
this is
more
like a procedural right. matter. I mean, it's all, you know, it's
yeah.
really, it's a tekes, but I mean, I suppose you're imputing some kind of responsibility.
Yeah,
by
tekes, David, means that it's
sorry,
like
ceremony.
A ceremony that they go through, namely the ceremony of the Egla Rufa. Right, okay.
I see, you follow what I'm saying.
Mm, yeah.
They need a lower standard of proof.
Mm.
One witness will do it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'm
so now,
pardon
me? Yeah, all right. I mean, what you said is correct. I mean, we did discuss that last week, if you remember. Okay. So, yeah. So he says, Hashto da Amrit, Eid Echon Haman. Now that you've established the fact that one witness can be considered trustworthy, right? Then either chad, so if there is another one who is giving contrary testimony, right? Heichi motzi machreshlei, how can he deny the testimony given by the first one? The Omar Ula, since Ula made the following statement. He said, "Kol makom sheheemino Torah eid echad," that wherever the Torah says that you give credence even to one witness, in other words, you're willing to accept the testimony of one witness as being correct, then in that case, harekanstein, which means that it is as if it has the same effect as if it were two witnesses. If the Torah is willing to accept one witness, then it carries the same stamp of validity as if two witnesses had come. Okay?
But.
So that's one thing. Okay. But we also establish, like, looking at the Mishnah, remember where they said, what if this and that and so on and so on. It says, V'yein devarav shel echad bimkom shnayim. However, if there is one witness, and there are two witnesses who give counter testimony, then in that case, what do we have to say? We have to say that we accept the testimony of two witnesses as against the one. And this, of course, the Mishnah had on the previous page, if you remember, that they discussed situations. Take a look again. Edechod Eber Rohisa is a Horegrit, right? The Edechod Omer Rohisa, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, in that case, one is contradicting the other, but it's one witness against another one. Then it says, Isha Omeris Rohisa, the Isha Omeris Le Rohis, right? Same thing, one witness gives testimony, and another one comes along and she says, you didn't, right? Then in either case, then it's Hoyo Orphan, right? Excuse me, it's Hoyo Orphan, right? Let's see, I skipped down a line or something. Yeah, in that particular case, we say that we do go ahead with the ceremony
with
the Egel Arufa.
Yeah.
Okay. Then it said afterwards, Eid Echad Omer Ra'isi, right? One witness says, I saw, Vishnaim Omerim Ra'isa, right? But two witnesses come and say, you didn't see it. Then in that case, what?
Well, you're off,
right?
Yeah.
They still go ahead with it, because we say that we accept the testimony of the majority in this particular case, who say that you could not have seen a murder being committed. We don't know, you know, you couldn't have seen a murderer. So in that particular case, they have to bring the Egel Arufa. Why? Because we don't know who committed the deed. Right. On the other hand, Shtayim Omrim Ra'inu, if two witnesses come and they say, we saw it, the Yechad Omer Lehen Lo'risam, and one of them says unto them, you didn't see it, then Lo Ho Yu Ofer. And in that particular case, they did not bring the Egel Arufa.
There's two against one. Right.
Yeah. So we see that while one witness will be accepted against one other witness, right? But if it's one witness against two witnesses, then in that case, we give greater credence to the two witnesses as compared to the one witness. Okay?
The evidence.
No. Right. Okay, let's take a look at it once more. Eda called him a Raisi, right? I saw the murderer, and the one of them says, you didn't see him, right? Then in that case, we say, Hoyo Ofer. In other words, because we say, since the testimony is denied, we don't know then whether the person who said, I saw it, is to be believed. Okay? Yeah. Okay, that's to establish another idea, namely what? That when it comes to one witness versus two witnesses, then in that case,
two
we give credence to the two witnesses rather than to the one witness, okay? Because we're not finished yet with this problem of witnesses.
But if only one of those eight already said,
Certainly,
if you add a second one on,
yeah.
Why do you need that case?
Okay. We're going to see at the end of the discussion that the problem is, in what way is the testimony given? Is it given by witnesses who come simultaneously giving, you know, conflicting testimony? Or is it given by a witness who comes and whose testimony is considered valid by the court? And then only afterwards somebody else comes in and brings in a contrary statement, you know, that this is incorrect. This is already a different problem that we have. So, right now we would have to assume that the cases that we're dealing with is where we have, at the very same time, one witness versus another witness, or one witness versus two witnesses, that they are there simultaneously before the court in order to present their testimony. Okay? The only way in which we can understand this. So what we said in the first case in, right, is that there are cases where Eid Echad Behemon, right, and if we accept that in this particular case that the testimony is correct, then what? It has the validity, Hare Kanstein, right, of as if it were two witnesses. But the next case that we're dealing with is if simultaneously one witness appears to say one thing and two witnesses appear to say the contrary, then who do we accept? We accept in that case the testimony of two witnesses as against two one witness. This is what we've said up to this point.
Well, because in the first
really
case,
good one,
yeah,
it may or may not,
because again, take a look at the Mishnah.
The only thing is, if you turn it around, then you see the principle of two witnesses outweighing one witness, or If they then had put a given, I know they did it later on. They should have put that case. They should have put that.
I think what they're trying
to do.
Okay.
To show.
They're trying to prove that they were.
They didn't have the two that said we did see, and one said that they did see.
Right. It could be one way or it could be the other way. Either it could be that Hoyu Ophin or it could be low Hoyu Ophin, depending upon what are they saying.
Your logic is correct.
Right.
I'm saying that case
is
not needed.
No, because they say when one witness is accepted as there were two witnesses, okay? Now they're showing that if one witness comes and there are two witnesses against him, then his status as two witnesses no longer applies.
What she's saying is that when you have one witness makes a positive assertion of seeing something, the second witness that comes to negate it, that second witness, unitary witness by himself, serves the purpose of negating the...
That's correct. But in that case, the result that would be who you want.
Right. Why do you need a second case that tells you that if two witnesses come against that one, then again, how you
are? No, but remember, the two witnesses against one could either be that they say, we saw and you didn't see, right? In which case it's lo hayu ofin, or the two witnesses could come and say to the one, we didn't see, you claim you saw, but we say we didn't, you didn't see, okay? And therefore, in that particular case, or you are offended because of the fact that
that's
we
correct,
still
but
right.
What I'm
okay.
saying is that if one negating his testimony is enough to invalidate his testimony,
so why do we need
why
two?
Why do you need that extra case to tell you that if two come along, again, how you are?
Yeah, but
what did you add? By saying
that? What we added is that it could also go the other way around.
But doesn't state
it
that.
But that didn't happen. They didn't put that in.
But the Mishnah
here.
Says that. The Mishnah
later,
says
later, huh?
That's why we look at the Mishnah. You see, what did the Mishnah say, first of all, right? And we're trying to analyze now, what is the Mishnah saying? Okay. So the Mishnah now is dealing with the case of two against one. It could either be that Hoyu Ophin, or it could be Lo Hoyu Ophin. We don't know what the answer is at this particular point. Okay? The Mishnah has an answer, but we're trying to discover how did the Mishnah arrive at the answer. Because obviously, there is a Machlokes among the authorities, as to how do you interpret the Mishnah. But at the same time...
I want to ask you this question. Yeah. I'm not trying to be a wise guy. In the first, they say, Isha Amirat Lari, do it now.
Okay.
Right?
That's something else.
The second
that's
they have, Eda Chad Amirat, is there anything
that...
There's
a case before that.
Right.
Okay.
In that case, you said one woman against another woman. Since we're willing to accept the testimony of one woman, right, and another woman denies it, so the result is as if it were one man against one man.
Right. They don't say what happens if a woman comes and makes an assertion and a man comes and says no.
Okay, correct.
What
that we didn't have. Okay, that's already you'll come to.
Okay.
Well,
yeah.
No discrimination.
We'll come to it.
Then maybe.
No. No, because of the problem that we have that for many cases, right, in many cases the testimony
women
of a
enough.
Woman is not considered valid, you see. So that this is another problem that arises. So we have cases where a woman's testimony is valid, and other cases where a woman's testimony is not considered valid. Yaakov. Okay, had a busy night. Yeah. Ah, fine. So sit down, take a Gemara, and learn with us.
We're
on Mem Zion all the days right now. Okay. Yeah. All right. So, to continue. All right.
Oh,
so far, this is the situation. Okay? This is what we said. All right. Now, so now we come to a machlekes, as I said. Okay? They're not in agreement as to how to accept the testimony, particularly of one against one. Okay? Ula said, to me, you should understand the Mishnah as follows. It says, Lo hoyu ofin. My statement is that if it's one against one, right? We said before that if it's one against one, we don't know, we're in doubt, and so therefore, hoya orphan. This is what the Mishnah said. But Ula comes along and he says, if it's one against one, then I say, lo hoya orphan. Because it remains in doubt, but nevertheless, the doubt is such that I don't think that it would be proper to go ahead with the egg lagruf. Okay? The chinam of Rabbi Yitzchak. And Rabbi Yitzchak also had the same opinion as Ula did. He also said to me, lo hoya orphan. Okay? So that's one side of the picture. Ula, who of course is an Abora, and Rabbi Yitzchak, who is a Tana, okay? Then, what is the opposite? The opposite happens to be, Rabbi Chiya, Omar, to me, he says, I say, you should learn the Mishnah as follows, Hoyu Orphan. That, in other words, if it's one against one, we don't know who's right, then in that case, they do go ahead with the egg lagruf because the element of doubtfulness as to who did the murder, you know, still is in existence. Okay? All right, so, they say, first of all, Ula Rabbi Chiya Kasha, right? So he says, for Rabbi Chiya, it's a Kasha. Or the Ula, right? The Ula Le Kasha. But in the case of Ula, it's not a kasha. In other words, as far as Rabbi Chiya is concerned, who says that Hoyu Ofrim, the question is, it's difficult. I mean, why should we accept that opinion? Because isn't it a doubtful case? It is a doubtful case, right, according to Rabbi Chiya. Mm-hmm. But if it's being denied because one witness says that I did see it happen, then in that case, we should... Yeah. Then we said the Ula Le Kasha, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not a Kasha on Ula, he said, Loi Hoyu Orphan, right? Why not? Because they say, Kan Bevat Achaz, Kan Bezer Achazet. We're dealing in reality with two different situations. Namely, the one that I already mentioned a few moments ago. Bevat Achaz means that at the very same time, simultaneously, in other words, the two witnesses come before the court, right? This one says, I saw, and the other one says, I didn't see. No, in that particular case, then what do we do? Well, we can either follow whose opinion, either Ula's or Rabbi Chiya. Either we would say, lo hoya orphan, or we could say, hoya orphan. But we don't know at this particular point, you know, which opinion to accept. Okay? But what if it is, God b'zeh achazeh, where first a witness comes, he gives testimony, and the testimony is accepted. We have to realize that, right? And then only afterwards, somebody else comes, and he gives testimony, and he says that, the original testimony was not correct. Then what is the court to do? What is the court to do in such a case? You understand? This is a problem. Of course, as a normal rule, the answer would be that once testimony has been accepted by the court, then in that particular case, it will not be overthrown by people who come later disputing it. That's a general rule. But naturally, we'll have to... we also have, you know, problems exceptions. I mean, one of them, of course, we feature quite prominently when we're learning Marcus, if you remember, with the question of Adam Zomerman.
Right. Yeah,
I mean, they come, right, and they say, I mean, how could you come and testify that you saw this and this thing happen when you, as witnesses, were not even present over there, right? You were together with us in such and such a place at such and such a time, and you could not have seen the event exactly that you say that you saw. Okay, so that already could be a somewhat later time. That the Adam Zomerman come, they don't necessarily have to come at the very same moment, but nevertheless, the closer they come to the event, you know.
Right, I mean, then people that are going to impeach
right,
the Adam.
Right, they're going to. Then, of course, you're going to have another son of witness come and say, Adam Zomerman, how could you testify when Emmanuel hated that? You know, you were together with us, and you couldn't have. Testimony is going on. Right. That was a very big problem that we had, the Marcus, at that particular point. Okay. All right. So, at any rate, All right. Tanan, we have learned Mishnah said, right, Ein Echad Omera. You see, as a horek, right, that one witness says, I saw the murderer. Ushnaim Omim Lo Risa, and two witnesses at the same time say, you didn't see it. Then in that case, are you orphaned? Because as we said in the Mishnah, the presumption is that we don't know that the first witness who claims he saw it actually ever did see it, since he's being challenged, you know, by two witnesses. And so therefore we still go ahead with the Arifa Sa'egla, we still go ahead and have the ceremony with the Yegla Rufa. Okay. But if it is one witness against another, then lo hoya orphan, right? And then they would not go ahead with the Egla Rufa. Well, if that's the case, then this is to Yuftor the Rabbi Chiya, and this is a challenge to Rabbi Chiya, right? It denies what Rabbi Chiya. Rabbi Chiya said that they would hoya orphan if it was one against one. Whereas the Mishnah, of course, says that they wouldn't. So obviously, then we are refuting Rabbi Chiya's opinion, correct?
Well, he's going against the Mishnah.
Right. So the Tameh, so now he's going to have a counter argument. He says, as far as your reasoning is concerned, he says, Amor Sefer says, look, I say, let's take a look at what it says further in the Mishnah. It says, Shnayim Omrim Ra'inu, right? If two say, we did see the Eid Echad Omer Lo Re'isem, right? And what witness says you didn't see, then lo hoya orphan. In that case, there is no Egla Rufa. But O Chad V'Chad, hoya orphan. But, yeah, of course, I'll not go. Okay, let it go. But if it is right, O Chad V'Chad, then hoya orphan. But the conclusion then would be that it's because two against one, right? But if it's one against one, then they should have the Eglat Rufa, because we don't know. So obviously there's a contradiction between the stand, right, of Ul and Rabbi Chiya. So he says, Ela masnisin kulav v'psuli eitz. So he says, rather, the Mishnah now really is not dealing with this particular problem. What are they dealing with? They're dealing with a problem now of the Sule Eidus, not, you know, witnesses who are normally accepted, but people who would normally not be accepted.
Disqualified.
Right?
Yeah,
well, as witnesses, either because there is only one witness and not more than one, right? Or they fall into the category of being, let's say, women who in certain categories cannot be accepted, right? Or katanim, you know, minors, we cannot accept the testimony of a minor, or avodim, and of course we don't have avodim these days, so that wouldn't apply anyway.
No.
But, you know, they are psulei eidus in the sense that in not every category of witnessing can the testimony be accepted. Okay, the Rabbi Nechemya, and this would be in accordance with Rabbi Nechemya's opinion, the Omar, who said, Kol makom sheheminu Torah eid echod, wherever the Torah says that we can accept the testimony of one witness as being valid, then halach achar rov deos, right? So follow the what the majority opinion would be. In other words, if one witness comes and we would accept it, but then two, you know, come simultaneously and contradict him, then in that case we have to follow
the larger number of witnesses.
Yeah, the larger number. And not only that, but we also say we also stay noshim beish echad kishnei anoshim beish echad. Furthermore, we say that if there are two witnesses who testify against one man, you know, and one man contradicts the testimony of two women, right? So the sages declared that the statement that you know, the testimony of the two women as compared to the testimony of one man, it is the same validity kishnei anoshim b'yichadot, as if it were two men testifying against one man. In other words, since we say halo chacha rov deos, follow the majority literally of opinions, but, you know, let's say the majority of testimony which has been given by the witnesses, and in that case, we are willing to accept the testimony of two women as against one man and give it the same validity as if it were two men against one man. Okay?
So in other words, women have an equal status here.
In this particular case, right. Okay? So this is one way of understanding Rabbi Nechemia's statement. But it says, V'ikah de'amrei, there are those who say, Kol heicha de'osa et echad kosher mi'ikara, that wherever we have one witness who is valid according to all opinions, that he's always valid, you know, to testify, whatever it may be, to begin with, then afilu me'ad noshim ki echodamyan. Then in that particular case, even 100 women are as if they're only one woman. Okay?
Now, I just hope that the rationalization of women...
don't hear that.
It all depends which part of the Mishnah they listen to, or which part of the Gemara over here. Right. The first one, we say, you know, that when we say that two women, the testimony is valid against one man, that sounds very good, right?
Yeah,
but now along comes a different opinion that says, punkt fakel, that one man whose testimony we cannot impeach, and the testimony is 100% valid, then even if you have 100 women testifying contrary to his testimony, but we wouldn't accept it as being valid. As I zokta. Okay, so we're having a problem over here. Needless to say, I don't think we're going to solve the problem. Okay, but it's a problem. It's a very big problem. As I said a couple of weeks ago, and I repeated again last week, in certain areas, the testimony of one woman is as valid as anybody else's testimony. And that's in the area of Isser Meheter, where if a woman testifies to whatever it may be, whether it is, for example, whether she saw a person being killed, or if she can identify a dead body or something like that, in order to be able to free a woman so that she could remarry. Right. If a woman should not remain in Aguna, then in that particular case, there's no question that we accept her testimony.
As to what if she's testifying to seeing somebody dead on a battlefield, or what? What is she?
Whatever it may be.
She saw she
recognizes the dead person. Doesn't have to be somebody who's been murdered. It could also be somebody who died a natural death.
No, I understand that.
Yeah. But she can identify the person so that therefore there is testimony to free the widow so that she could remarry.
Okay.
Not talking about collecting the kesuba. More important that she should be able to remarry, you know, that she should not remain in Aguna, you understand? Which is, you know, that's a more difficult category than Islam, whether to collect a ksuba or something like that, okay?
Right.
Thank you, Rona.
She's fast.
All right. The Hawker says the Maya skin, and you're dealing with, okay, Kigon de Asai Isha Mekar. The first one who arrived was a woman, right? The Teatzah, the Rabbi Nechemia, right? And we then apply the dictum of Rabbi Nechemia, right? The Hochi in this particular case, namely that Rabbi Nechemia says, Omer, right, Kol Mokim She'emina Torah Eid Echad, wherever the Torah says that we believe the testimony of one witness, then Haloch Achar Rov Deos. Then in that particular case, we follow the majority opinion, the also shtei noshim, the isha achas, yishnei anoshim, the ish echot. And we said, you know, that the testimony of two women who testify, right, against one woman has the same validity as the testimony of two men against one man. Avol shtei noshim, the ish echot, but if you have two women who testify against the testimony of only one man, then it's kipalgo falgodo. Then it's like 50-50. In other words, we don't know one way or the other. Okay? And that's the reason why, you know, let's say in the case of should we have Hoyu Ofim or no Hoyu Ofim, well, that we have to see. All right.
Why do they go back to that again?
Huh?
Why do they go back to that again? They already said that if one man testifies for it and if 100 women testify against, they said that they don't accept the testimony of the 100 women, right?
Yeah. No. They would have, no. They already said that two women have the weight and testimony of two men.
Right?
Now they contradict this and they say,
they say that two women have the testimony same as two men. Read a little more carefully. Okay.
Two women against one man has the same weight as two men against one man.
That's
right.
Correct. In other words, there it is. Halo chacha rodeus, right?
Well, what is the implication of that? Then there, if the one man is a constant, then the two women and the two men are also a constant, right? The two women outweigh one man. Two men outweigh one man. So therefore, the two women and the two men are equal.
Now
they go back and they contradict it.
Okay.
Now they say
two women
and one man, they're equal. They don't...
They're saying one man and then
and
fifth.
Now they're back to Rabbi Nechemya, right? Trying to figure out Rabbi Nechemya.
It's different than what they said before.
Yeah, okay, correct.
Before they quoted Rabbi Nechemya saying two women against one man,
right.
They say two men against one man. But
right.
Now they're saying... That is two women against a woman is the same as two men against a man.
Yeah. Also, say Noshim be Ishachot, right? Okay, correct. This is correct. Yeah. That two women against one man has the same validity as two men against one man. Right. In other words, they're willing to accept the majority opinion over there, right? But then you have the Iko, the Amre, there are those who give a contrary understanding, a contrary interpretation of his words, right? Because they're saying, again, they quote the same thing, that if one kosher witness came to begin with, right, then even 100 women, right?
That's what I was saying.
Right. It's only as if, that they were one woman. You understand?
But they said that before, but I don't understand why they repeat it again.
Well, what they're saying over here right now, again, is really to
emphasize
question,
them.
Right, emphasize, but also to raise the question, do we or don't we have an Egel HaRufa, right? Based on that. This is what they're still struggling to...
Yeah, but the question of witnesses again. Here you're talking again about one man against 100 women.
Yeah.
And taking the one man's testimony as valid.
Yeah.
And they said that before, but why are they repeating it again?
They're repeating because, first of all, Rabbi Nechemya's dictum has been challenged, and so they're trying to give it a slightly different twist right now. Okay.
I think the people that are trying to undermine the argument are trying to introduce
a new
parallelism and say, well, when we talked about two women equaling overbearing the testimony of
one
man.
Right.
What we really meant to say was that in a situation where you had two women against one woman, we considered that as if there were two men against one man.
Yeah.
We didn't mean to
right.
say that if you had two women against one man, that the women, the superiority in numbers, overbore. What we
right.
meant to say in that case is
yeah.
that they're equal. That all of a sudden two women
right.
are now equal
correct.
To
right.
one man, which
right.
is
right.
really...
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's different. I mean,
of course,
it upsets the majority rule.
Exactly.
It upsets the
argument. It does, right. I mean, I think that David analyzed it quite well this time. Right. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
That's why we have a lawyer.
Yeah. No, it's like the Constitution. You know, the Constitution had it, which is really a shameful thing, that a black man, in two centuries ago, they figured it out, his worth is 3/5 of a white man. Right, this isn't the Constitution. The way they enumerated to get the when they were going to divide up the representatives by population.
Yeah.
It's in the Constitution itself that they would count Negroes as being the equivalent of 3/5 of a white man. Right.
Yeah.
Well, here now you're counting a woman as being the equivalent of 1/2 of a man. This is what this particular argument is saying.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is matter how many women would come along,
there would still be
they would be equal. put them on all the women on the scale.
Right, exactly, exactly. Exactly.
Of course, the one man too has to be one who I consider an eight kosher. If he's not an eight kosher, then that's a different story.
It's the majority rules, but if it's two women against a man, then you're equal.
Well,
that
doesn't
that
mean
if
you have 50 women against a man,
does it?
Still
right.
Does
yeah.
That's
yeah.
What
I,
they're
I
saying.
Don't see the
law.
That's logical.
No, Ron is right. I mean, this is
one.
Right.
You have two women against
this
one man that's
trying
equal.
To,
this
to,
is equal.
To develop the statement of Rabbi Nechemiah to fit in with a different preconception.
You then say if it's 50 or 100, it's the same as two? That's we'll have to see. I don't think that it's necessarily correct to say that.
Right. But again, I mean, also we said before that the man has to be an eight kosher. What if the man is not an eight kosher? And in that case, women without weigh him.
Well, that is.
They wouldn't have to. If he wasn't an
eight kosher, then he
wouldn't.
It would be accepted.
Yeah, but I'm talking about an eight kosher, one whose testimony is accepted in.
Good
for
point.
All types of testimony. That's what they mean by eight kosher. Okay. By eight kosher, they mean a man who has no psul.
Okay.
No psul whatever. In other words, his testimony will always be accepted as being valid testimony. He has nothing to cast a shadow upon his validity. You see, the Gemara in Sanhedrin states, you know, that there are witnesses whose testimony we either consider, you know, as being possible, right? There's a psuliatus, you understand?
Mm-hmm.
Or only in certain cases we say, well, maybe yes or no. Let me give you an example. Okay. Comes to somebody who is, for example, an inveterate gambler. Okay? Gambles all the time. So, in this particular case, the Gemara wants to know, can we accept the testimony of such a person? Because morally, there's a question as to, you know, whether he's fit to be a witness that we can always rely upon the truthfulness of, for various reasons. I mean, the Gemara says, because Einam Bokim Yeshua Shalaylam, in other words, he's so given over to the running to Foxwood or to the racetrack all the time or whatever it may be and so on, that he doesn't take the trouble to go out into the world and find out what a person has to do in order to make a living. So how can he go and, you know, give testimony in ordinary cases, you know, where people are involved, you know, that they're having disputes about the various relations.
But this would mean the character of the witness,
There's also another thing, I mean, because...
But Rona has a point. Let me guess. Rona's point is that... If in that case, even if there was no other witness opposing him, his testimony would not prove the proposition because he's disqualified as a witness. Then you don't need to have a majority of women to overrule.
He is disqualified as a witness in a case like, for example, Didymomenos. No question that he was disqualified as a witness in those cases.
In that case,
but over here, where it's a case of where we said that we're willing to accept the testimony of Eid Echad at Sefer Oilon. You understand?
Uh-huh.
If somebody comes and says, so in this particular case, we would accept his testimony if he were the one and only witness. Even though we would say in other cases we wouldn't accept him, right? It would be the same thing. He is normally postula edus, but in this particular case, if he actually saw it happen, then we would accept it.
Okay, and then is he considered as, in the situation, is he considered as a man as opposed to the women, or is he considered on the same status?
He would have the same status as a woman in this particular case. In other words, it would be palgo palgo, half and half, one against another, okay?
So if two women came and to negate his testimony, then they would...
Then they would outweigh his testimony, absolutely right. That's the point that he's making over there,
So, the man was the gambler.
Yeah.
Who, in, as you say, in the he's a pasul.
Yeah.
All right. But in this case, because it's just a question of observation,
yeah,
what he saw or didn't see, he's a valid witness.
Yeah.
In kasher. Right. In this case, what you're saying is that two women's testimony would be equal to his testimony. Right? Two women's testimony would be equal.
Could outweigh his testimony.
Well, it's equal. It's plaka. I mean, it's equal. It's equivalent. You don't.
All right.
It doesn't say it'll outweigh it. It'll be.
But it could also be one woman against him. Same thing.
How
as long as he's apostle Laedis, she is apostle Laedis.
No, but in this
the
case, he isn't apostle Laedis. He's an eight kasher, is what you said.
No, we're not saying he's an eight kasher. We're saying
in
that he's apostle. He's apostle.
Well,
but we're willing to accept his testimony
in
this
case.
He
is, but in other
all right,
case.
So that's what we're saying. It's exactly what we're saying. This one says eight kasher mi yikora. Person to begin with, he's an eight kasher. You see, so he's in a different category. I mean, there. By the way, there are other psuliatis too, based upon, for example, that an aid cannot be related by blood to a person in the case, you know.
To the defendant.
Right. When I say, not solely the defendant, that would be, let's say, in a criminal case.
Okay.
But what if it were a, you know, dini mominos?
Okay,
understand?
So might, yeah.
Maybe yes, maybe not. That's up to the judges to
obviously
decide how.
Yeah.
How about this, the letter?
How about what?
Yelid.
A yelid? Minor, you mean? You mean a katan?
Katin.
Well, as a normal rule, we do not accept the testimony of a minor. But maybe in this case, if he were the only one and were anxious, as I said, let's say. Well, here with the Yagla Rufa, yo nay nay. I mean, do we go ahead with the ceremony or not? But let's say if the Katan was able, he saw a murder taking place, or he saw a man die, and he knows who the man is, would we accept his testimony? So I say, if it were necessary in order to free a woman from being an aguna, then in that case, we would certainly accept his testimony. So it all depends what's going on. I can't give you a blanket rule because you have to go according to individual cases.
I'm just curious.
Yeah.
Are you saying that, take the gamma, are you saying that he's actually, although because he's disqualified from being witness in certain kinds of cases, in a case where he is accepted as a witness, he's considered on a lower status legally than a man who's an eighth kasher?
Yes. Yes. But it doesn't mean that necessarily his testimony would be negated.
Right.
All depends upon what is the story.
What
I mean,
he
says.
What the
natural conclusion also that two women against one man would be equal, that one woman against one man would the man would be winner?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. Because we said, I mean, one against one, we don't know. Do we go ahead with the Egla Rufa or not? We don't know.
Oh, is he? Well,
yeah.
I'm saying
about
one man against
one
woman.
Against one man. I'm saying one man against one woman. If we say that two women against one man are
equal, right.
Does that mean that one woman against one man is immediately the man who
well,
one belief?
I would put it this way. Probably more credence would be given to the man's testimony against the woman. But inasmuch as in most cases we require at least two men to give testimony, so the testimony of one man alone, and then in those cases, it would be as valid as the testimony of a woman, which in other words, it would not be acceptable.
I think
we need more. We need more witnesses.
If I can just offer a different opinion, I think you could read that in light of the statement that if you bring 100 women, it will not outweigh the testimony of one man. So if you have one woman, there's one 100. It will fail. That testimony will fail. I think if you read it in the light of
that.
But you see, that's right. That was the second interpretation of what did the Rabbi Nechemya mean.
In the light of that,
I'm talking about according to Rabbi Nechemya.
Right. What did Rabbi Nechemya mean? You see, that's the second interpretation, not the first.
I know. But if you think, I mean, I'm just saying it to try to judge one way or another, because there's not a clear statement. We don't have that case. Maybe we'll come to it.
Right. Okay, yeah, I'll probably spend the rest of the evening just arguing the point back and forth. Okay, at any rate, they got tired of it too. So they asked the question, Matati Psula Edis Lomali, why do we have to bring too many, you know, two cases of people who ordinarily would not have their testimony accepted, and, you know, in this particular case, we're willing to accept it? So he says, Ma'udatayma, what if you say, Ki Asinim Basarot Deus, then where do we follow a majority? It is L'chumra, wherever, you know, we reach a conclusion that you have to be strict, severe in your judgment, but Avola Kula, no, but if it's a question, you know, of a majority against, you know, a minority, where we would say Lakula, in other words, we accept the easier one. So we'd say, then in that case, definitely that's out of the picture. So he says, Kamash Malon, therefore, these two cases show to us that whether it is Lakhumra or Lakula, but the majority opinion is very important and has to be reckoned with. And so, therefore, what applying it to the Egla Rufa, as I said a little bit earlier this evening, right? If you follow the opinion that you have to have the Egla Arufa, so then in that particular case, it's based upon the fact that what? That the majority opinion has prevailed against the minority opinion. But again, if we say that you don't go ahead with the Egla Arufa, that's also based upon a majority opinion against a minority opinion. So in other words, we would say that we have to consider the majority against the minority, whether it is to arrive at one conclusion or whether it is to arrive at the other conclusion. Okay?
Yes, that's the halakha.
Yeah, right. So this is what they say. Yeah.
Right.
Pardon me?
So that majority of the
in this particular case, right. Gender. Right.
Correct?
Yeah.
Majority of the
that's what they're saying, the majority is ruling. Mm. But as you can see, I mean, there are all kinds of qualifications or ramifications and so on, you know. It's not as simple as it sounds. If I would say simply, majority wins, fine, very good. Therefore we have, and what if it's one against two, or two against one, and what if the one is this, and the two is going to be, and so on and so forth. So it shows, you know, that it's not as simple as it sounds on the outset. Okay. All right. So now, the Mishnah then went into a description of how things began to go wrong, okay, with human society, and so on. Okay. First case, Misharabu ha-Rotzkin, right? When murderers began to increase, Rotzachon, or something. Nobody would say Rotzkin, but it's a Rotzachon name, Rotzachon. You know, if you add a nun onto a root letter, very often the implication is this person does this regularly. Okay? Yeah. We've had words, you know, not nice words, like, for example, chamson, right? Somebody who is always engaged in seizing things that belong to other people, right?
Chamson is a miser.
That's a Kamsan. That's a Kamsan. Kamsan's a miser. Why is
thank
he
you very much.
Klapsen.
He always keeps his hand, keeps his hand, his fist closed, you see. Right? Right? He doesn't want to open it up to a poor man, so he's a Kamsan, okay?
Yeah.
Chumsan.
Huh? Okay.
Right, you're right. That's not
okay.
Right.
Good.
Yeah,
good.
That's from the word Chometz. How it developed, I don't know, but there it is. I mean, that's the root of it, anyway.
So,
it's chometz, it's on
so the
it's
same
so,
root.
Right.
Chamsan is
right,
someone that's
right.
Always taking things that don't want.
No, that's a chamsan, not a chamsan.
Oh,
right.
Hamas
right.
Means something like
right,
violence.
Right,
oh,
okay,
I'm sorry. Chamsan.
But we have,
okay,
I mean, on the other hand, we'll take the word rachamon, someone who is always merciful, right? So that's a rachamon. And then, of course, I don't know how to classify a kablan. Kablan is a contractor. But they can be the worst kind of him in Eretz Israel, as my daughter can tell you, or as my son can tell you.
Jews are good, I don't know.
they take money in advance on the promise to give you a dira, and then, boy, did they do that. Got nothing.
Never give money in advance, yeah. That's the rule.
Yeah, but unfortunately, in Israel, you have to. Yeah. In Israel, you have to, unfortunately.
Oh, really?
Secure your... Yeah, there are certain things in Israeli society. Not quite what we have in this country. Okay. All right, so... Bisharaba Harod Samchim. All right. So he says, on Rabban Bisharaba Harod Samchim, when murderers increase, then what? Botla Egla Rufa.
They stop.
Then the whole ceremony of Egla Rufa came to an end. Why? Lefi Shaina Boa El Atsofek. Because, as we said before, why do we have the whole thing about the Egla Rufa? It's because we don't know who committed the murder, right? But here, what do we find? Right. So, Misharabu Haratzanchim Begolui. That's the model, this is the important word right now. So that, therefore, when people knew openly who were all the murderers, then Bokla Egolruf, in that case, that was the end of it. There's no point to an Egolruf anymore. Because,
for
example, right, if you have a tabloid, they identify Al Capone, John Gotti, and all these things and so on, right? And you know that this one is a murderer, and the other one is a murderer, and so on and so on. So you're going to have an Egolruf. So it's the same thing even in those days. Unfortunately, as times degenerated, right? So, and murders increased, so there was no point anymore because it was no longer a rare case, but unfortunately it became too common a case that people would be murdered. Okay. Likewise, Misharaba Noafim, when people indulged in adultery and the whole business increased tremendously in society, I mean, Chas v'Shalom, I hear, they quote statistics now, to justify, why don't they make a sentence about Bill Clinton when half of America is doing the same thing, people are engaged in affairs right and left and everything.
Yes.
That's
right. Yes. That's right. Yes. Yes.
All right, listen, Larry Flint is already he's redeemed himself.
Oh, yeah, sure.
How did he redeem himself?
Because these people that are throwing stones, they're the ones that are doing the same thing. Why should you condemn a man for doing something you do this to do yourself? Like you said, it's not
But it's not redeeming Gewalt geschehen. It's only adding more schmutz in society. What shall I say? It's adding more schmutz. That's not redemption.
He condemned Clinton. He's not a man that had Lieberman.
No,
the word
that
I asked you is
a
senator from Connecticut.
There
are people that have condemned Clinton who are hypocrites.
What's that got to do with this?
All right.
It has nothing to do with this.
What we're showing is that here we have a case against
Lieberman.
All right. Do
what we're discussing.
Genug, let's get back. Yes. The word begalui was added already in the Gemara. That's not in the Mishnah to begin with. Right.
But begalui means that they're just coming straight out and murdering a person in front of the whole world, right?
Yeah, right. And everybody knows all about it. They know who the murderer is.
So there's no question of Egla Rufa there, because everybody knows.
That's why they cut it out.
Correct.
That's why they cut it out.
I have a problem with that also.
Egla Rufa doesn't come up in a situation of murder.
Oh, what they're saying.
That's correct.
What they're
saying is that that was it.
There were so many murderers that
from that point on, they decided no more Egla Rufa.
Yes,
that's all.
But there were so many murderers that people didn't know about. Then they decided, okay, no more Egla Rufa.
That's exactly it.
But then they say.
Right.
Then Butler.
Yeah, then the whole thing. I mean, they decided that's it. There's no point to try to continue even to try to apply the evidence.
What does Kaloy mean to you? That the murder's cleared out in the open?
Out in the open where anybody can see.
I think what they're saying is they're saying that you have gangs. I mean, I'm imputing this, so maybe way off. That you have gangs that have in the past committed murders. Yeah, whether it's in Netanya or wherever, New York, Chicago. And so that when they find another body lying on the ground, they impute it, they attribute it to this gang warfare.
To the proliferation of murderers in the place,
So in that case, they say, well, we don't need an ANCLA roof.
Something we don't need. I mean, they say it's hopeless.
This is just a question of, retaliation between one against the other.
Well, David, I think that what...
Not actually seeing it in the open. Once they see it in the open, there's no question.
I think that this implies the fact that it was hopeless. It was hopeless to apply the whole business of an ANCLA roof in a society in which murder became so commonplace.
I mean, I understand that.
Became commonplace.
That's how I understand.
So what's the use in having an ANCLA roof in those cases? The same thing when adultery became so common, then in that particular case, what did they do? So they did away with the Mayim HaMoreh, right?
Yeah, right.
All right. And they give the reason, Tana Rabbonim, right? Sages say, the Pasuk says what? Beniko ha'ish me'avon, right? That the man is literally free from sin, okay? Of course, that's not the real meaning, as I pointed out sometime in the past, that what it really means is that, if the woman has committed adultery, then the husband is guiltless in the matter if he accuses his wife, because Shitakim is guilty. But that's not the way they now interpret it. How do they interpret it now? If the man himself is free from sin, right, Bizman Shaish Minukam Yovon, then in that case, Hamayim Bokines Ishto, then in that case the water will be effective in testing his wife, right? But Ainho Ish Minukam Yovon. But if the man himself is guilty of having committed adultery, he's not literally cleansed from sin, right? He's not clean from sin. Then in that case, ain't a mind don't kill his sister, right? Then the water will not
prove
test
anything,
The Omer, and then they bring another pasuk. And this time it's a pasuk taken from Hosea, where it says, "Lo efkod al b'no sechem, kisses deno," etc. Which means, I will not punish or something like that your daughters if they sin. Why? Because according to Hosea, this has become so commonplace that it's not out of the ordinary. Okay. My Omer. So now Gemara says, so why do we have to have another pasuk in order to show us, that my Hamorim no longer effective? The Chi Taymor. So if you argue as follows, you say, Avon di day in, that if he's the one who's sinning, and committing adultery, then in that particular case, right, then the waters will certainly not test his wife, because
he's not clean,
But if we say, Tibone udebante, but if it is the sin committed by his sons or his daughters, lo, then in that particular case, the waters would be effective in testing the man's wife. So we say, Toshma, this is why the Gemara continues and it says, Lo efkod al b'no sechem kisis nena v'al kalo sechem kisinu afena. I will not, literally visit punish your daughters if they sin, nor your daughters-in-law, or possibly your brides, whichever way you want to understand it, if they commit adultery. V'chi teimor. And if you argue as follows, Avon eishes ish in, right, that if the man sins by having an adulterous affair with a married woman, then in that particular case, the waters cannot test his wife, right? But Avon Dipnuyo lo, but if we say that if he commits adultery by having an affair with a penuya, in other words, a woman who is not married, then in that particular case it's still kosher. Or as the old joke goes, then in that particular case, And no, not so. Toshma, because then the pasuk continues, because it says, Ki heim im hazonos yifardu, because they go off together with whores. The im hakadeshos is bichul, and they sacrifice together with the kadeshos, because the kadeshos were the temple whores in the Canaanite religion. So in other words, it makes no difference whether they're married or unmarried women. The point is that if they are unfaithful to their wives, then they are guilty of whoring, so to speak. Okay? My v'yam lo yavin yilovet. And what is the meaning of another pasuk which says that if a nation which doesn't understand or people do not understand, they will have all kinds of problems? Omer Rabbi Elazar, Omer Lehem. So Rabbi Elazar said as follows: Omer Lehem, Novel Israel. The prophet said to the people of Israel, Im atem makpidin al atzmechem, if you are strict with yourselves that you did not commit adultery, but you are faithful to, you know, your marriage, to your wife in marriage, and in that case, mayim botkin nishoseichem. In that case, the waters can test your wives. They are to be in love, but if not, ein hamayim botkin nishoseichem. Okay. Now we continue with other problems in society. Misharavu balei hanoah, when people lived only in order to have pleasure. Present day society again, right?
Yep.
People live only for pleasure. Then nisavsu hadinin niskalkalu hamasim. Then in that particular case, judgment or the courts of judgment became corrupt, right? And also people's deeds became corrupt. Not only that, v'yein noach ba'olam. And there is no peace in the world as a result of it. Okay? Or as Rashi says, Rebbeinu Shel Olam is very unhappy with the situation. Okay? Stage number one. Misharabo roe ponim badin, when they're increased, the people who are looking for all kinds of deals when it comes to judgment, then botel, then they became useless, what? Lo soguru. The pasuk which says that you're not to be afraid of any man, but you are to render strict justice based upon the facts itself. Because, in other words, once people, started to play around, and you have smart lawyers and things like that, then justice began to fly out of the window. Okay.
I think you're talking about bribery here.
Well, I mentioned also that, yeah.
Council.
Well, Forsak, not only that, but also they came to an end, Lo Sakiru, that you are not to show preference in judgment, right? Not to be afraid, not to show preference. Foku ol Shamayim, and also they cast off in themselves the yoke of heaven, Binostu Alehem ol Bosavadov. And they took upon themselves instead the yoke of being subservient to human beings. Misharabu Lokoshe Lechishas Vadin. Then, as they're increased, those who are always whispering to the judges, how to affect judgment, then Rabbah Charon Afi.